Hi, this is Against Everyone with Connor Habib. Friends, in times of obvious schisms between human beings and their structures, there can be a stirring up of opportunities that only the frenetic and urgent intensities schism times can reveal. Obviously, we are in such a time right now, and in a time like this, we can see that there have always been many pathways available to us, that we were stuck, and that we can be there for each other and dissolve obstruction. I do think that occultism and esotericism is one of the great stimulators of new thinking, because it's weird, because it offers pathways that we don't usually think of. And so even if you don't end up taking an occult or esoteric path, it can inspire or give a springboard into new thoughts and new possibilities for what the world could be. A world that is culturally, politically, and economically invested in materialism, though, is going to have a very difficult time looking into the foundations of materialism and its missionary forces of consumerism and scientism, and also what used to be called new atheism, but what is actually just sort of a politicized atheism. People who do talk about materialism, especially science and medicine in any sort of critical way, can end up reflexively throwing away the value of that materialism, including materialistic science. Additionally, this throwing away can show up in what I believe are immoral ways, like condemning people for using Western medicine, trying to keep their communities healthy, talking about their concerns about the planet and planetary changes, trying to stay healthy using mainstream advice on nutrition, or, you know, whatever, just tending to anxiety, mental illness, all that with these Western materialistic methods, these scientistic methods. So I want to just say at the outset, I'm not condemning any of those things. I think people need to do what they feel is best for themselves, reach for their best options. I certainly have many times. but some of that stuff comes up on this episode. What I'm interested in is how we interrogate the series of knots and ties that bind our ideas of reality together through materialism, while at the same time offering understanding to each other and ourselves, acknowledging the fact that we are all tangled up in this together, and that it's not going to be easy to see our way through, and we need to offer a kind of compassion and love to ourselves as we're going at this task. Also, what happens when we start to undo those knots? Eventually, will we even know the world we're living in anymore? Will it appear to us even remotely like the world we live in now? Reflect on that. A general idea that the world is not made out of objects, but evolving states of consciousness, something that is non-material, not stuff, not matter. I asked one of my most popular guests back onto the show to discuss all of this. Ari Torreson is a writer, teacher, anthroposophist, acupuncturist, veterinarian. That's a mouthful, and he's from Norway. His two most recent books in English are the most relevant here because they both reference the Nordic tradition and the Christian traditions that we talk about on the show, which are Travels on the Northern Path of Initiation, Vidar and Baldur, the Three Elemental Realms, and the Inner and Outer Etheric Worlds, and also Encounters with Vidar, Communication from the Outer Etheric Realm from Clairvoyance to Clairaudience. That's a mouthful, and maybe you don't know what any of that means. If you want a, sort of a primer on some of the things that Ari and I talk about, you can listen to earlier episodes with Ari, including episode 116, where we talk about demonology and the nothingness of Christ, and episode 205, where we talk about white magic and Ragnarok. I know all this probably sounds like a lot, and each of these episodes, as well as those books I mentioned, draw on Norse mythology, healing traditions, the Christian mysteries, occultism, and science. So with this episode, quite frankly, the range and depth is not diminished at all. We go all over the place. Time, space, physics, science, animal communication, nothing is off the table for interrogation and questioning in this episode. I don't highlight, by the way, all the strangeness in any sort of sensationalistic way. Just rather to show, look, when we really talk about things, when we really start to question phenomenology, metaphysics, when we start to question ontology, you know, the ways we learn things, epistemology, when we start to question reality itself, things get weird. And that can show us how different the world can be if we start asking different questions and take a different approach. So I hope this episode with Ari is enlivening to you. I recorded it with Ari in his home in Norway. And there's another episode coming up with me talking to someone in their home in a much warmer climate. I'll talk about it when we get to that episode. I'm just bringing this up to say, sometimes if someone's really in their work, you can get so much out of just sitting with them in their environment and talking with them, and you can see their home, their culture, their tradition coming through, even just sort of walking through this snowy landscape and to walk up some icy hills just to get to Ari's house. You begin to walk into, in a way, that person's mind, that person's being, by walking through the landscape that they live in, if the landscape they live in is important to them, and if, in fact, they are working with that landscape in one way, which Ari definitely is. That's all a preamble to just say, I'd love to do that more. Before lockdowns, I used to only record the show in person. I'd like to try to go back to doing that, to meeting people where they are and sitting down and talking with them. Obviously, I won't always do that because people I want to talk to are all over the world. But your contribution on Patreon makes a huge difference in my ability to just go and do that work. Patreon.com/ConnorHabib is the way to support the show. You can give a one-time annual pledge, or you can give monthly pledges. However you want to do it, at whatever amount you feel is the most useful to the show and that you feel good about offering. The great thing about Patreon is that it is so different than just paying someone for their labor. Every episode I do takes a different amount of time. Obviously, going to Norway to meet with someone and having a conversation, that's going to take a different amount of time than if someone lives here in Ireland and I can just go sit down with them on their couch down the street. However, I think that Patreon offers this model where you're not paying me for my labor. You're saying, hey, I like that this show exists. I like what it makes me think. I'm interested in some of the things that come up for me as I listen. It makes me want to have conversations. It makes me want to jump into your conversation. It makes me want to read these books by the people that are on, or maybe listen to their music or think about the things they've said and bring them into my own life in some way. So it's not, you do this work, I pay you, which is ultimately unethical. And I'm trying the best I can to make what I do in the world match my moral sense and, of course, the ethics that I believe in. I don't really believe in the wage labor relationship where people have to work or die. Actually, some of this comes up on this episode a little bit, where, you know, you get paid for your time, and if you don't put in the time, you don't get paid or whatever. That doesn't make sense for anybody. So I don't want models in my life, or at least as much as possible, that rely on that kind of wage-labor relationship. Patreon really helps artists, creators, podcasters, whatever you want to call a podcast. Is it art, a creation, whatever? It helps people like me get out of that trap, and I think by popularizing this new model, it can help others get out of it as well. So all that is to just say, it's a good way to support a show that is for free. Every episode of this show is for free, including all the other episodes with occultists and this little series that I've done over the past few episodes with Mitch Horowitz and Duncan Barford and Alan Chapman and Pilar Lesko in the past three episodes. So patreon.com/ConnorHabib. That's it. Here's my conversation with Ari Torsen. Here we go. So all year, this year, I've been contending with an illness. I won't say what it is for the listeners. Maybe I'll tell you after we're done. But one of the things I think about a lot is I could go probably to an allopathic doctor, have this taken care of in whatever way they take care of it, etc. But in fact, I've been learning so much from the condition that I've been challenged with and facing. I've been gaining so much from this that I have decided to just stay with it and see where it goes. It's been very frustrating. It's been hard, but I've learned so much from it. At what point do you think it's appropriate to step in with intervention to heal versus to receive the gift of the illness?
Well, that is a question that I cannot give an answer to anybody, because you have to decide that for yourself. For example, one of my major moments in life was I was 35, and I had a major brain stroke. And I was paralyzed, half my body was paralyzed. And I was sure I was going to die. And I had no 1 second the thought of calling doctor or ambulance. What? Not one single second. I was just lying on the floor. And I thought, oh, now I'm going to die. That will be interesting. And I was actually expecting death and looking forward to it, and after a few hours I thought, why I'm still alive. And then I came to this conclusion, it's all psychic. This is a psychosomatic. I have no brain stroke. It's just because I was then in a divorce situation. It's just that the life is so difficult, so my subconscious just give me a sort of break from it. And with that conviction, into a few hours more, I was up walking, and the next day I was back on work. So I wasn't even away from work 1 day. But I went to a doctor and got a brain scan, and they said, wow, you had a major stroke. You should have been paralyzed. So the point is, it was a real stroke, but I had no fear. I welcomed it. I had not one thought about intervention. And it went away in 12 hours. And I think that is very important. If you welcome a disease as given to you by karma, although, of course, the adversarial forces are in a disease. But if you welcome it, and that has been important in my teaching lately, if you welcome it, you love thy enemy, you love the enemy, the disease, then it change. Get Christianized and do not harm you.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about this moment you describe, or the experience of the stroke, because first I was to ask, you know, my experience with that was I went to the hospital. I had been assaulted. This was in 2007. I'd been assaulted by the guy I was dating at the time, not the guy you just met, but the guy I was dating, he'd broke my rib. I had internal bleeding, all this. And while I was there, they told me that I had lymphoma because they had induced CT scans on my, and I just refused. I just said, I'm not
I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to listen to this language or enter the labyrinth that you guys are setting up for me to go into with this. And I just walked away. And I know that there was I don't advise that for anybody else. It's not my medical advice or anything to anybody. I know everybody is very different. But I know that had I entered in, it would have killed me. Had I entered into their language, their question, the tests that they were offering, their diagnosis, it absolutely would have killed me. So that's one example. I didn't greet it with love as you. I greeted it with some terror, some fear. But I also knew that the context they were offering would be deadly to me. So I think there's that too. So I do want to talk about the bringing Christ and love to the disease process and experience, but also the ways in which there are languages around and beings around certain medical processes and procedures that if you enter in, you can become trapped. And it is different for everybody and different in every instance, but you see what I mean?
Yeah. And because your condition was maybe deadly and my condition was maybe deadly, you cannot give anybody else advice.
Correct, yeah.
You can only take that decision yourself. Do I trust the healing powers? Do I trust Christianizing of the elemental being that is the disease? Or not. And in that instance that I had with the brain bleeding, the stroke, I didn't even consider it. I didn't even think about calling ambulance. And that afterwards, I think that is strange. I'm a medically trained person. I've studied both veterinary and human medicine. I get a stroke and I don't even think about calling an ambulance. It's almost for me, myself, sort of understandable, unthinkable.
I think this is such an important thing to bring up with healing, because I think so many of us, different times in our lives, consider healing to be a responsive act. But also, healing is, I don't like this word, but you see what I mean, an attitude. Healing is a state of being as well. So the first aspect of medicine we encounter is the disease comes to us, how do we look upon it? That is the first medicine that's available to us. And in fact, it is the way that everybody treats every illness. Everybody that has any kind of illness, it could be a paper cut to, you know, terminal whatever, the first thing they do is the thoughts congregate within their consciousness and they have to deal with. They have to deal with that congregation. And that's never really talked about in medicine. The closest I think people come in sort of is like, oh, the power of positive thinking and healing and all that kind of stuff. But that's not what we're talking about here. It's actually who in you, who of you meets the disease process when it arises itself.
Yeah. And you know this, when you are acquainted with the elemental world and the elemental beings, every disease is also an elemental being. And these elemental beings, they want to be acknowledged and they want to be released and freed from their bondage. And maybe diseases are a way that they want to show themselves in the possibilities that our own life and karma offer them, and then they show themselves as diseases. And then they expect to be released. And instead, we do different therapies and just translocate them and do not release them.
you know, when I think about translocation, which we've talked about together on previous episodes and you've written about, you know, I think about what many things, but one of the things I think about is, okay, so yes. So I bring the beings of the medical method with me, and yes, they can expel and then translate, because you're actually bringing beings against beings when you treat with a certain medical.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
It reminds me of the landscape beings as well, the landscape elementals, that when you have electricity and you have the, when you create a new environment, it pushes and obfuscates the presence of the other elemental beings. So it's almost, we can view it as what kind of landscape do we want, yes, want to be? What kind of forces do we want to bring to this spiritual landscape of our being?
Yeah, I totally agree. this is perfectly expressed. And it becomes more and more clear for me that we live in a world of elemental beings, and we, our body, ourselves, our organs are sort of brought into material existence by elemental beings, and they long to be freed. And this is actually, when I speak this talk now to you, maybe disease is at least partly an expression of this longing to be released.
Disease process can be ours because of karma, but also the beings that are involved, when we meet them out of our heart, we are connecting the elemental kingdom and the angelic kingdom. They're meeting. And I think, you know, this is the moment that we live in now. It's very clear to me that there is this redemption. I'll just use this word, but this redemption of the elemental beings, especially the fairy beings, of wanting to meet with the angelic kingdom. And they can only do it through us now. And there's an opportunity for it now. Again, we talked about this a little bit in past episodes, but it hasn't changed. If anything, because of the way in our landscapes, the elemental kingdom is being, our connection to them is in some ways being weakened. They're being weakened. They're asking more and more to be strengthened, to be given an attentiveness through us, to be given an attention, to be given strength through us, so they can do what they need to do to meet the challenges with us of what's going on in the world right now. So I'm sure illness, it'll be interesting to see what kinds of illnesses begin to show up as that expression, as a way to meet and be redeemed and to meet the angelic kingdom through our own bodies.
Yeah, and you can observe this change of diseases as the elemental kingdoms opens more and more. The third realm with the Luciferic elemental beings opened around the end of the 1800s. And then it was fever diseases that had to do with the immune system. Then from 1950 on, it was the Arimanic, which has to do with sclerotic diseases, arteriosclerosis, joint problems. That was important. And now that the first elemental realm of the elemental kingdom opens fully, where the Asuric beings are, there will be diseases that attack the eye and the blood. Like in COVID. COVID was an Asuric disease.
It's so difficult, I think, for people to contend with that, because when new sets of beings come to present disease processes for us, we don't at first even recognize or see that they're disease processes, right? So we almost see them as existing in some other realm. So I'm imagining these the pathologies or the diseases of the eye, the ego, that would come at first will not we won't even think, oh, that's a disease. Not because it's hidden, but because we have one conception of how disease works. And I think that that's really hard for people to get. It's just like a, you know, autoimmune disease, right? We say this. that could not have existed before we had the concept of the immune system. So the immune system comes, we have this kind of idea of how the immune system works, how these, and in some ways it's arbitrary, in some ways it's not, how we say these aspects of the body are the immune system. And then suddenly we have autoimmune disease because we've come up with this concept. Mm. Until we have new concepts of the I and the ego, we won't even understand that the things that are coming in are disease processes. So how do we even identify them and then call them something that needs to be met with medicine, needs to be met with some form of treatment or love or what, you know, whatever? Because they will be unrecognizable at first.
They will at least be new. For example, I talked with the doctor and he said there was one thing that has not been discussed with COVID. It was very much hallucinations and ideas. And they got this thought that the reality is like this or this or this. And that has, of course, to do with the I ego, or we call it ego I, you know, in English is the same as I. Consciousness, and that is attacked by the Asuric beings. So we will have more and more ideas of the ego, I, that does not relate to reality. So Andrew Steiner described that this culture will develop more and more into a war of all against all, where everybody have their own worldview. So there will be a group that think that the earth is flat, some the elliptical, some round, some... So there will be more and more differentiated groups. That is part of the Asuric attack.
I see. So right now, I see this thing happening with... almost... There's a preparation for this in the outpicturing of it in world events. So with the Israel-Palestine, I don't even like to call it a conflict. That's not the right word for it. But now there's so much propaganda and so much being driven, especially to Americans, but also Europeans. I won't even talk about this or that about the geopolitical situation, but what I'm finding with all these protests, this massive, you know, swelling, upswelling of protest against it, is that people have decided we can't actually find the truth by listening to the facts that are presented by the pictures that are being given to us. The only truth that we can really find is the moral truth. And the moral truth says we don't want people to kill other people. So in some ways, I feel that's almost a horrible preparation because it involves human sacrifice. But a preparation for being able to say, well, I cannot actually trust the picture, but I can trust what is true with my heart. And the moral sense tells me we do not kill other people. So I think that will again be the guide in the case of these diseases. It won't be about killing other people. Well, maybe it will be killing other people, not killing other people. But it will mostly be that we have to develop morality, which is something that we're not very used to. We're used to talking about things in just the political realm, which is just about ethics. How do we arrange this, 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 this? Not developing a moral sense. Mm.
Absolutely. And this morality in politics, which is almost lacking totally, because you talk about, it is about money. How much does it cost? How much do we earn? And in this conflict you mentioned, who is right, who is not right, what, and all this, it's not about moral. And this moral aspect, you know, it was Leonardo da Vinci. He had a lot of inventions, different war machines and different aeroplanes, and he had a lot of invention. And on some of them, he wrote, should not be developed, it is not moral. So he had a sense of what is moral and not. And for example, I have this problem now with my family. I had a house which I sold to a person, and I said, okay, you get it for this price. And he said, good, I buy it for this price. And we agreed on that. And then these, especially children, come and say, but Dad, you could have got more money for it if you had done like this and this. And I said, yes, but I have never in my life sold anything to earn as much as possible. I find out in my head what is an acceptable price, what is a moral price, and then I sell it for that, even though I could have got more. And this thinking is so uncapitalistic, so sort of I remember I was approached on a Congress, that is 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, there was some American company that was selling lasers. And they say, we make this laser for this much amount, let's say $1,000. And we can sell it to you for, let's say, $2,000.
Like a medical related?
Yeah. We sell it to you for $2,000, and then you can sell it for $5,000. We earn $1,000, and that is okay for us. And you earn $3,000. But then I said, no, I won't go into that, because that is not moral. I don't want to earn $3,000 just to further a laser. So I said to them that I don't want to do this. And it's not moral to earn that much. And I cannot take less, because then the others that sell for you will, of course, protest, because they cannot say 5,000, I say 2,500. And then 2 or 3 years later, I met these people again in a Congress, medical Congress. And they said, they shouted, oh, that's the one who didn't want to earn as much as possible. We have never met anybody who had that opinion. This is so un-American. And I just looked at them and said, well, it's still my opinion.
I'm thinking about that, you know, moving the cultural aspect of here's something that you can use to help people, and then just pushing it into the political or the economic realm and asking those realms to take care of what you would do. I mean, it's absurd. It's also when you sell the house and you say, you end up working with money, with number, with quantity, completely different when you're not just trying to make the number change. I'm not trying to make this number increase, add. I'm actually allowing it. It's in some way its own freedom, because now the number, the quantity meets me in honesty, in what I actually want to use it for. So in some ways, when we do this, we change not just economy. It's not just immoral to deal with, you know, selling something for more than it's worth, whatever. We actually begin to distort the economic realm itself when we do this. And it makes it harder for everybody else, but it also messes with the elementals of the numbers, the elemental beings that are in here in number and quantity itself. And so then they have to come to us again. And there are so few people doing that work to redeem the elemental beings of number and math even, and quantity. So that's another, I mean, that's already a hallucination that people deal with in their egos. They see these numbers in their accounts and it has all this like meaning and all these pictures and starts directing them in all these ways. So that's already a way in which that kind of pathology has reached us.
This is developing as we talk. Mm-hmm. And I must actually say that this talk with you just now gave me even more ideas about the importance of treating disease correctly or not treating. There was, when first time year I was studying, there was, in Oslo, we had a party together with some Irish doctors, students. And one of these, I remember now, this was in 74, I think, was singing this, "Now I will sing this Irish song," he said. And he sang it, and I just remember, "The doctor must know when to heal and when not to heal." And it made such a deep impression. When is it right not to heal? And I just, that thought is in medicine actually outrageous. But now I have come to, it is more and more important not to heal directly, because that translocates. You have to sort of sneak in the Christ consciousness to say, so to say, you must open the middle and sort of go in there so it can transform these elemental beings that is related to disease. Sneak in was, of course, a little...
I see.
I didn't mean to say it that way, but...
like a thief in the night.
Yes, sort of.
Well, I like that you say creating disease, because, I mean, after all, homeopathy is almost a way of creating a disease. Let me back up. I like that you say creating disease, and that actually is part of, I guess, what must happen is not just that someone gets a disease, it's cured, but that actually we can also create conditions for people to face these adversarial forces which are related to their karma and overcome them. I mean, those are some of the rituals of indigenous people would do that to begin with. I mean, these are why some of the rituals involve pain, involve starvation, involve whatever, is so that a difficult condition can be met and overcome. But even, I would say, homeopathy, which seeks to create an image, a presence of a disease process and give to you. I mean, vaccines to a lesser extent would do the same thing, but to put it in so you can meet it and overcome it. So is creating disease actually part of the future of medicine as well then?
No, that is the translocation, I think.
I see.
Homeopathy is pure translocation, because you create an image of the disease that look exactly the same. Like cures like. And then you, in a way, insert an elemental being in the body that look exactly like the elemental being of the disease. And in the elemental world, like repels like. That's why in old churches they had small devils on each corner to repel the devil. And that is why also evil beings, vampires included, they are frightened by their own mirror image. If you show a ghost or a vampire a mirror, you scare it away. And that is homeopathy.
Well, but the difference I mean, I've done different versions of homeopathy, and it's clear to me that some versions of it are helping me get in touch with my own healing forces versus trying to crowd out the disease and translocate it, right?
I thought about classical homeopathy.
Yeah, yeah, I see. Yeah.
Like cures like. Yeah. You can use homeopathic remedies in another way. That's fully possible to make it transformative, but then you have to be aware of this process and not do it translocative. Anthroposophic medicine is a mixture of these. They use homeopathic remedies. They use organ remedies.
Yeah.
They use tissue remedies. And they use remedies that translocate, but they also use remedies that transform, especially like hepatodoron, which sort of balance the liver. But still, when there is a liver problem, you give hepatodoron, then it is a fair chance that you translocate this elemental being that creates problem in the liver. Mm-hmm. So you should do something else, actually. So I would say that homeopathy is like, say, 90% translocative. Mm. And anthroposophic medicine may be 60% translocative. Mm. School medicine, 99% translocative. Classical acupuncture, 99% translocative. But if you change the acupuncture, as I've described in my book on acupuncture and translocation, you sort of take the system and put it in a 90-degree way, then you can transform the process. But you have... let's say if you have a liver problem and then you treat something else like the bladder, then you can actually have a transformative effect on the liver. But if you treat the liver directly, that is like attacking your enemy, and that drives him away. And that is a translocation.
Uh-huh.
But this is very radical and very difficult to think. It is as if, let's say, you have two young boys who fight. One is stronger, one is weaker. And you step in as a grown-up and say, stop now. And you take this stronger in the neck and shake him and say, stop attacking smaller or weaker. And then he runs away. Instead of sort of going between them and then talk to them and make them friends or change them. That it would be the right thing. Everything that go directly on something frightens it away. And when I look at Monty Roberts dealing with horses, that's an American
horse whisperer,
yes. When you stand directly and look at the horse, it will not come to you. If you stand in 90 degree with the shoulder towards it, then it comes.
Absolutely. I mean, something I learned about animals a while ago was I used to be afraid of dogs when I was. I had a one of my own dogs attacked me when I was younger. But as I got older, I realized if, not just with dogs, but many other animals, if I look at the spine connected to the base of their skull and I could see that and try to meet them in this spot rather than here. I meet them very differently.
Wow.
And very often, they'll also even lean into me as I do that.
You have discovered this 90-degree principle then.
Yeah.
Not the snout, but the neck. 90-degree.
Yeah, that's it.
The spine.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was just something that I began to learn over time. And that also, I don't want to say I hear the voices of the animals when I go to the spine, but I feel there's a communicative thing happening much more if I try to talk to the animal through its upper spine, if that makes sense.
To me, it makes sense, but to 99% of veterinarians, it probably don't make sense.
Wow.
I was actually amazed this
really?
Yeah.
The
because this principle of transforming a disease is the Christ principle, that is, love the enemy. That symptoms are the enemy. So when you, let's say, have a headache, you must not take something against the headache, but something completely different. When you are afraid of the biting mouth of a dog, you sort of go 90 degrees into the neck.
Yeah. Well, that was... It was also, again, just the communication thing. When I moved to Ireland, I was dating a guy who had... We had a poodle together. And I knew I would miss the poodle. So I knelt down and I put my hand on its neck. And the thing I would imagine is it's golden up here. And I put my hand on its neck. And it said, I mean, it didn't open its mouth like a puppet and speak to me, but it said, well, don't worry, because whenever you pet any dog, you're petting me. So don't worry about it. So then when I could go to Ireland, any dog I met, I felt that I was with the dog back home. So there's some sort of connection between all the animals in that place as well, I think. I want to ask a question that's been now... It's been with me for a while, and there is not many people to ask. It's a question about anthroposophy, which is, why are there so few anthroposophical healers? So you see, if we go to other Christian, esoteric Christian traditions and groups, Daskalos, the Research of the Truth, Bin Sedwana, Peter Dunov, and the White Brotherhood, there's healing. And it's not... Of course, some of them use medicine, all that sort of stuff, but there is not the mediator of the medicine. There's a different kind of healing tradition. Why not in anthroposophy? This has begun to vex me, and I'm trying to understand more and more what happened there that it could not find its... place.
Well, it's quite simple. There are several reasons. First, Rudolf Steiner said that all anthroposophic doctors should be also ordinary doctors in the bottom. And then there is, so you have to be an ordinary doctor to be an anthroposophic doctor. And the anthroposophists are very, they want to be sort of taken seriously. That's mean this is ordinary. This is also ordinary medicine, and then you cannot have healers. This is in the whole concept of anthroposophy. They sort of accept science, as Steiner said several times. There is science is valid. We just have addendum, something extra to spiritualize it. Maybe he wouldn't say the same today, but he was very clear about that in 1924, 23, 25, that there is no opposition between anthroposophic medicine and school medicine. And that is why also during the COVID, the medical section in Göttingen, they went out and say, we are not against the vaccine. We are not against the normal medicine. We just add something. While healers, they do not say that. They say that the whole school medicine is not good. We need surgery. If you have an appendicitis, we need a scalpel, and so on and so on. This is a difficult area, problematic area. And I guess I am somewhere in the middle between these two extremes or these two views. I think that as all therapies, most therapies, including anthroposophic medicine therapies, they tend to translocate. But as I said earlier, let's say, in the totality of anthroposophic medicine, about 60% translocation and 40% transformation. School medicine or cancer therapy, almost 100% translocation. Chemotherapy or radiation, it drives out the elemental beings, so they go over to other people. And the radiation and chemotherapy also leaves the patient quite destroyed.
Yeah, and again, well, I won't speak for you, but I will say for myself, I would still not tell people do it, don't do it, whatever, you know? But if people who are listening don't have the same sort of spiritual outlook that's aligned with some of the things that Aryan are saying, I mean, you can see clearly that medical waste from hospitals makes people sick. That there are all kinds of physical effects, and the physical material world of treating people in certain ways with these kinds of medicine that then make people sick again. I think when I'm thinking about the lack of anthroposophical healers, what I'm wondering is why it has not shown up in many anthroposophists. Like, as I go more and more on this path, which I go till I die and then keep going, the healing aspects of me begin to, I think, at least open. I'm not at the point where I can touch people and heal them, or maybe I am and I don't know it. But I wonder why, if people who are anthroposophists are meditating on working with Christ, the healing capacity is not waking up in them. This is what remains a mystery. Not just did Rudolf Steiner teach this or that, which is also important, but why is it not coming to people through their exploration and in intimate relationship with Christ? That's a lot to say, but I...
Yeah, and I'm just listening. I'm not able to comment on that. I think it's very important within anthroposophy is to experience the spirit, and then you have to go into the spiritual world and not just have this all knowledge. And that is what I work on in the Vidar path, or the Nordic path of initiation. And that also is revelation of how to treat. But still, I'm not there at the healing, what you talk about. I have to consider that a few years before we talk about that, or I can comment on that.
Next time you're on the show, we'll have a different conversation. But it is, you know, when I think about, I've brought this up to you before, but these healing traditions, not Reiki, which is, I think, as you say, translocation, I think that's mostly, but in certain traditions, Braheri, which is the Pennsylvania Dutch healing tradition, in the Irish divining tradition of healing, what I think is mostly happening is that some of the things that you're talking about, which is finding the Christ point, but going to the Christ within the person and meeting them and encouraging a relationship for healing to flourish.
And that maybe is something of what you are saying.
Yeah.
What I more and more treat, I treat less and less the disease. I treat the awakening Christ in the middle. It can be the middle of the body, the middle of the organ, or the middle of a joint. It can be all these things, but still it is a healing. I had, for example, I was in America, Canada now, and there was a boy who took the hand on a very hot stove, and he was crying, had burned his hand. Then I sat at a distance, and I tried to open the middle of the elemental in the hand, and inviting Christ, and within a few seconds, this burning healed, and he looked at it, and he said, pain is gone. So that was a healing, of course. I didn't do anything else. I was just sending healing, but intended healing through the Christ in that elemental, pain elemental that was in the hand. I saw the pain elemental. I opened the middle, asked Christ in.
When you say the burning of the hand, it reminds me so much of someone I know who studied with a student of Daskalos. He told me that he was with his friend who burned his hand on a coal stove, put his hand down, and screamed. He grabbed him by the wrist, and he just went, "Come with me, come with me." He started snapping, and they moved over, and then he put his hand under the water, and then he pulled away, and there was no burn on his hand. And it was because, this is a different way of working, but it was because he broke up the logical unfolding of what would happen with that wound. He found his way between, in the middle of the cause and the effect, so that it opened up and something new happened. So there is something about this Christ point that you're talking about, finding the Christ that's beyond time. I'm with you until the end of time. Beyond time, beyond cause and effect. And because it exists there, the cause of the disease may not bring the effect of the disease anymore. Does that?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
I actually want to talk about this 90 degree angle, or this sideways, because it is something that's been coming up so much is for me lately, is how important shape is. It's something that's largely ignored when it comes to medicine, that actually shape matters. We can see this with all sorts of things, all sorts of figures, that shape has an inner quality. If I walk in a circle, I feel one way. If I walk in a square, I feel another. If I walk in a star, I have a different inner experience. A bacteria or a virus has a shape. It has a different kind of shape, and when the shape enters, there is an effect. And so a lot of healing arts now rely on shape. We were talking about homeopathy before, but also biogeometry, form drawing, these sorts of things. And they have healing effects because they have a certain shape. When we talk about an angle, are you talking about, one, I want to know, are you talking about shape? Are we talking about a certain shape that echoes part of the cross, also part of the pentagram? Or are we talking about So first I start there, but then I want to talk about the way that shape comes into illness and healing.
Yeah, well, it started, actually, my thinking of this was the utterance of Peter Duno, who said that he said that I do not want to go into medicine. I don't want to go make hospitals like Steiner did, because all healing in that way is translocative and it just comes back. The only real healing he added is 90 degree. And he didn't explain. And
where did he say that? What do you remember? Was it just a lecture about
this? This is so difficult with the these translations and Bulgarian.
Yeah.
I cannot at all. It's not like Steiner. You say GA 125 page 200. and then it comes to what Steiner described as the most important in future is not when, not what you do, but when you do it, he said, as the morning and evening forces, as contrary to the midday, midnight forces. And they are in a 90 degree angle. He said this Christ Sophia forces is morning, evening, and the Lucifer Ahriman, midnight, midday forces. So when you do it is important. And one is healing to the other. And that means that the 90 degree line from morning, evening is healing to the midday, midnight. Or you might also say the Pisces Virgo line is healing to the Gemini Sagittarius line. So then I brought that white further, so you can see that all lines of the zodiac can be healed by the 90 degrees. If there is something wrong in one axis, it can be healed by the 90 degree axis. And then you see that in medicine, I tried that now for a few years. When there is a problem in one axis, let's say the liver, then the 90 degree axis is urinary bladder. Then I was in Calgary last year in the veterinary clinic of Uli Schell in Calgary. And there we, during 3 days, we treated all patients in 90 degrees. And she followed them for 1 year. And a few weeks ago, I got the email from her saying that all dogs had been cured. And additionally, there several of their owners had been cured. Because with, if you bring then this Christ healing in the 90 degree, which is also the cross, then it spreads and it also heals the owners without the owner being treated at all, but through the dog. It's quite fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So when it's also when you have the, I mean, Peter Arjunov saying, look, if you have a problem with your left ear, take your right hand and put it, treat it with your right hand. Don't put your left ear, your left hand on your left ear to deal with it. So even the opposite side, only you can't have a 90 degree angle without using the opposite side, almost in a sense. You have to employ crossing over crossing, the boundary of the center line. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting.
But this is such a deep mystery. That means actually that you must, as we started to say, you must love the enemy. You must love the disease and the symptoms. You must not treat them. You must actually treat in a 90 degree angle or a cross angle. And then you can introduce a totally different process, a process of transformation. And that is why I call the middle point the Christ point, or this 90 degree sort of a Christ treatment, because that is, you do not attack the symptom itself.
Uh-huh. Which is why I would also say then, maybe with, you know, anthroposophical medicine, the idea of the upper and the lower body, it's not just about nerve sense, metabolic limb. Mm. Don't worry, nobody listen, you don't have to know what those things are, but just that, you know, Rudolf Steiner makes a lot about when there's a problem in the lower body, actually manifests the upper body. When it's in the upper body, it manifests in the lower body. Yeah. So again, there is a crossing of a threshold as try to work.
But that is mirror-wise.
Uh-huh.
This takes it a step further.
Mm.
You see, that is known in anthroposophic medicine or used in also in homeopathy or acupuncture or anything. Is there a problem in the upper, heal it from the lower.
Yeah.
If it's on the left side, heal it from the right side.
Yeah.
But this is actually take it a step further. If there is a problem in the, let's say, the head, you treat it from the left hand, 90 degree out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so if we're talking about obstructions and spiritual development, so not what we would call illness or healing, typically, I'm thinking about that practice of the magic mirror, something Franz Barden writes about, instructs people to do really early, this magic mirror. Write down every bad quality and then think about the good quality, you know, that mirrors it and try to, and just to see. He doesn't...
Yeah, but mirror is again 180 degrees.
Yeah.
That is not 90.
Yeah, well, magic mirror he calls it, but yeah. So it might work with a different ecology of light there.
That is known. This mirror is known from both acupuncture and several other medical systems.
Yeah, well, the question I'm trying to formulate here is something about spiritual development, not illness and healing per se, but when we encounter an obstruction or a challenge in our spiritual development, is there a place of this 90-degree angle, a place of not directly facing the challenge, but is there a sideways?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is what I try to promote, to make aware. And this is a ongoing process also in myself, because I have to be aware what is 90 degree, what is directly attacking, what is 180 degree, and 270 for that matter. That also is an aspect, you see. All four directions can be applied. East, north, south, west. South, north, east, west.
Up and down as well.
And in the foundation stone meditation, which you maybe know, there is always on all three levels of the elemental world addressed spirits of the north, south, east, west. Hear it? May human beings hear it.
Yeah.
There you go to that human beings become aware of this. He actually say this, north, south, east, west. There comes a 90 degree in.
What is it then with the Vidar? So if people are interested in reading, what you should just read Ari's book on Vidar, well, two books on Vidar, but one more specifically. But one of the things that you wrote about, which was so shocking to me, because it was, again, something I was experiencing as I read your book, experiencing in my own life and then seeing it on your page, was the presence of a spiritual presence that came not at a 90 degree angle, but at a diagonal from the base of the skull up through the sort of center point here, which is not
clear,
the same kind of
clear angle. Audience.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that I was experiencing that. It was the movement of presence from the back up to the center, and then also on the sides, as if it was forming some kind of helmet on my head.
Yes.
So so that's just to talk about the other angles that come in, not just, so we don't, people are listening and focus, oh, 90 degree, everything's 90 degree, but also there are these other angles that bring spiritual presence then too. Mm. So we don't get too, people listening don't get too confused.
And you know this as Steiner said, that you shall not see Christ in the etheric. You shall hear him. And hearing, then you have this 90 degree. And if you look at these old pictures of Madonna, Maria, and the child, she has this halo with 12 stars. Mm-hmm. But the little child have this two trumpets out of the ears and one up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have a book here. Actually, I saw a book I've read, the Vidar Flame Column. About, so Vidar, maybe you just here, we're coming to the close, but maybe you just give a quick expression of who Vidar is so people will know. I'll say something in the intro, but just to say about his ears, about his ears opening.
Yeah.
And that is reflective of something that's happening in our own time in spiritual development as well.
And that is what Rudolf Steiner said, that Vidar... And I add, in connection with Balder, will bring the new clairvoyance. And the new clairvoyance is not clairvoyance, but that is a clairvoyance audience.
Clairaudience, yeah.
No, clairvoyance audience.
Oh, okay.
Because it incorporates the third eye.
I see.
And the two ears. So these three streams meet in the center and then go up as one stream to the crown chakra. Mm-hmm. And that is a clairvoyance audience. That is a new clairvoyance. Mm. And Vidar is bringing that. Mm-hmm. And only he can bring that.
So
you have to meet him to get that.
Yeah. What is it? Something in Vidar's forest world. Oh, goodness. What is the line? It's so beautiful. From the editor, I'll look it up. I'll put it in the show notes. But when we talk about Vidar, I actually think a good place to end is to say who he is and what's happening with him now, so that when the show ends, the last thing we've talked about is, here, we'll just introduce you to him, and then we say goodbye, and then you can think about it as a listener.
Yes, that's it. Vidar is has been the guardian angel for the Bodhisattva Gautama Buddha. For many, many, many eons. And when Bodhisattva became Buddha 600 years before Christ, then this angel, his guardian angel, was free. And that was Vidar. Then he was supposed to be elevated to the rank of archangel. He was angel. But he waited 2,500 years because he was asked by Mikael, who was the archangel of the sun for a long time, to step into his place when he became an archai. So today Mikael is no longer an archangel, but an archai, and Vidar is doing his work on his bidding, you might say, on Mikael's bidding, as an archangel, bringing the new clairvoyance and bringing the new Christ experience from the north to the south. That is Vidar.
And it was interesting to me that there's not as much on him as many of the other Norse gods we see.
No, I mean, because he was the quiet god.
Yeah.
He waited.
And we find him at the end of time with his boot holding up the mouth of the wolf.
Yeah.
So it's also a long time until Vidar's presence really takes the center stage in the myths that we have available to us, at least anyway.
Yeah.
All the way to the end, after the death of the gods, is when we really encounter...
Yeah, when the old gods die, he take over, kill the Fenris wolf, which is Ahriman, and then brings a new Christ impulse.
Uh-huh. Well, I think... ending with the introduction to Vidar is the best place to end for people listening. May they hear it. And I always feel less... I always feel more alone when I talk to you and less alone when I talk to you. More alone because I feel, you know, more committed and in my spiritual path, less alone because I see what you're saying. I can understand it, and I feel you can see and understand many of the things I'm saying, so I feel very less alone. So it's very good to have both those feelings at once, and I really appreciate talking with you again, Ari Thorsen.
Yeah. Thank you. Until next time.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Bye now.